From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The Senate impeachment trial of President Trump moves to an important new phase today. House managers and the president's defense team have finished their opening arguments. Now it is time for senators to ask questions of both sides. And by the end of the week, we will likely know if witnesses will be allowed in this trial. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales is here with us now. Hi, Claudia.
Hi there.
And senators will have 16 hours to get their questions answered. Beyond that, how will this round of questioning work?
So both Republicans and Democrats will take turns submitting these written questions. The Chief Justice will read these questions aloud to each of the legal teams. Questions can be directed to the House managers or the President's counsel. And the senators themselves can't ask the questions. They've got to be submitted in writing. Mm. And the question must be signed by the senator asking it. And questions can be from multiple senators. And we're getting the sense that maybe we could see 10 to 12 questions in this first phase of questioning.
And start with the Democrats. What do you expect their approach to the questions to be?
So even with Republicans, Democrats, I see them using their questions as an opportunity to strategize and poke holes, in the Democrats' case, in the president's lawyer's presentation, and really pointing to the question of witnesses. This is going to be their last opportunity to make that push, to make that case, that they need witnesses to get a fair trial. So I expect them to be going after that legal team in that way.
Yesterday, the president's defense wrapped up its opening arguments faster than it needed to, really, and they made the case that Democrats just disagree with the president's policy, but that a policy disagreement shouldn't rise to the level of removing the president from office. Here's Trump's attorney Jay Sekulow speaking yesterday.
To lower the bar of impeachment based on these articles of impeachment would impact the functioning of our constitutional republic and the framework of that constitution for generations.
So now let's talk about Republican strategy. Are they falling in line with that argument, and do you expect we'll see it reflected in their questions?
Yes, they are largely falling in line with that argument, and I think we will see it reflected in their questions. I spoke to one Republican senator yesterday, Mike Rounds, and he was mentioning that he would like to just get clarifications. He had about 9 questions already set up to ask. And so those are kind of the issues that they may go after, is these clarifications. But at the same time, I expect them to do the same thing and poke holes in the House manager's case and demonstrate we don't need witnesses in this trial.
On the issue of witnesses and additional evidence, earlier today I spoke with the number 2 Democrat in the Senate, Dick Durbin, and asked him if he'd be open to a Republican concession to read former National Security Advisor John Bolton's book manuscript in a classified setting. As we know, in that manuscript, Bolton said that Trump told him he was withholding Ukrainian aid until they agreed to investigating the Bidens.
What a hoot. The notion that this is somehow classified information. In just a few weeks, John Bolton's going to be sitting there with pen in hand autographing these books for the world to read. But we have to read them in a classified setting? What is that all about?
And now we're hearing that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said that he doesn't yet have enough Republican votes to block witnesses like Bolton or additional documents in the trial. What's the latest?
So he did tell his caucus that last night. However, what we're hearing largely from most Republicans is they remain opposed to this question of witnesses. There are some members who have not revealed how they will vote when the day comes. There's at least 3 that we think are open to it: Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Susan Collins of Maine, and Mitt Romney of Utah. But we don't know if there might be a 4th member if they do vote for these witnesses. So it's still hard to say if Democrats can reach that threshold, because since they don't control this chamber, they need 51 votes. They need to flip 4 Republicans. Not clear if they'll reach it in time for this potential vote on Friday to call witnesses.
Right. We'll find out soon. Now, what about this idea of a witness swap, which is bringing in both Hunter Biden, who the Republicans want, and John Bolton? Democrats seem to not like the idea, generally speaking. But this morning, West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin told MSNBC that he actually supports the idea of a witness swap and calling Biden.
Is Hunter Biden a relevant witness, Senator? I think so. I really do. I don't have a problem there because this is why we are where we are. Now, I think that he could clear himself, what I know and what I've heard, but being afraid to put anybody that might have pertinent information is wrong, no matter if you're a Democrat or Republican.
And some Democrats are actually worried that Manchin might ultimately vote to acquit the president. How does all of this shake up the equation?
So those comments this morning by Senator Manchin were very surprising because Democrats, for the most part, have been shooting down this idea of a witness swap. And so he's the first Democrat to say this. And he's likely on a Democratic island with this idea. And it sounds like some Republicans who might have been interested in this idea as well are also dropping it. So right now, it seems like it may not shake it up that much.
Well, we are walking toward history, regardless of how this ultimately turns out. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
A story now from Kansas, which in 2017 changed the way it handles children who commit crimes, creating stricter standards for sending them through the court system. Now, kids who commit low-level crimes stay in their community rather than going to jail. But the largest foster care contractors in Kansas say the result is more children with mental illnesses and violent behaviors coming into the already strained child care system. Nomeen Ujiadeen of the Kansas News Service reports.
Jonathan Stahl's house in the city of Olathe is crowded with bedroom doors, decorations, and eight kids. There's a lot of joy in Stahl's life, and a lot of challenges. Seven of those kids are from the foster system. He and his wife specialize in taking in teenage boys with behavioral issues.
Sometimes you're up at 3 a.m. because a kid's had a flashback, or you bring in kids that have never had rules before, and you start to have rules, and you're butting heads about that.
It's often challenging to work with foster kids, many of whom have gone through serious traumatic experiences. But lately, some foster parents and the contractors they work with say it's gotten harder. There are more and more children coming in who are acting up, sometimes destroying property or hurting other people. Stahl, who's been a foster parent for 5 years and trains other parents, has noticed too.
There's definitely an influx of teenagers into the foster care system, and more kids with behavioral issues, with criminal backgrounds.
KVC Kansas and St. Francis Ministries, the state's two largest private foster care contractors, say that's because of the changes to juvenile justice. They say the 2017 law brought in more kids with high needs and psychiatric issues to a system that already doesn't have enough foster families or mental health treatment. The system has been criticized for letting children sleep in offices and run away. Last year, advocates sued the state for frequently moving foster children from home to home. Linda Boss is the president of KVC Kansas. She says the new system isn't working effectively.
Parents are saying that they're overwhelmed, they're scared. They want their youth to get better. They want their youth to get treatment. They're just not sure how to make that happen.
She says since the change, foster kids have attacked her staff, families, and other kids more often. Some have brought weapons or caused thousands of dollars of damage at offices. Boss says employees have quit because they don't feel safe at work. Some foster families are worried for their safety, too, and they think that kids won't have an incentive to behave without the threat of going to jail. But Greg Smith, a former state senator who helped craft the bill and leads the state's Juvenile Justice Oversight Committee, says sending children to jail isn't the answer. He says before the bill passed, many children experienced more harm than good in prison.
We were turning kids that had minimal involvement with the system into kids that turned out to having more and more involvement with the system.
Since the bill took effect, the number of children in the state's only juvenile prison dropped from 209 at the end of fiscal year 2017 to 166 2 years later. Smith says the law could be improved, but he still thinks it's working.
We're just now starting to get the data to come in to where we can look at this and see, have these reforms made a difference, a positive difference? What do we need to tweak and how do we need to tweak it? But again, we need to base it on the evidence, not just because somebody feels that there's a problem.
Nearly all of the state's counties have immediate intervention programs. Now there are more kids in therapy, addiction treatment, and other alternatives to jail. Nearly 90% of children complete the programs successfully. Smith is skeptical that the changes are to blame for foster care's problems. The Department for Children and Families, the state's welfare agency, says there isn't a lot of data on this issue. Deputy Secretary Tanya Keyes says there has been an influx of older children with behavioral and mental health issues, but she's not sure if those are the same kids who would previously have been in the juvenile justice system.
We may not be exactly sure why or what has caused that shift of increase in older youth.
Jonathan Stahl, the foster father in Olathe, says ultimately the system isn't equipped to heal troubled kids and their trauma.
There has to be an option other than punish a kid with foster care or punish them with jail.
What they really need, he says, is quality mental health care and a loving, stable home. And many kids aren't getting that, no matter where they end up. For Here and Now, I'm Nomi Nujia-Dean.
Last night in Deep Blue, New Jersey, President Trump held the first of two re-election rallies this week.
While we are creating jobs and killing terrorists, the congressional Democrats are obsessed with demented hoaxes, crazy witch hunts, and deranged partisan crusades.
And in Iowa, Democrats running for president are making their closing arguments ahead of the caucuses on Monday. For this and more, let's bring in our political strategists. Angela Rye is a Democratic strategist and joins me here at NPR West. And Matt Makowiak is a Republican strategist, and he joins us from KUT in Austin, Texas. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Hey.
Well, before we get to the 2020 election, let's talk about the impeachment trial and really its impact on the election. Even though it's projected that there will not be enough Republican Senate votes to remove Trump from office, how do you think it's weighing on the minds of voters? Do you think there are any voters undecided on whether or not to remove President Trump? And if so, if anyone is reaching out to those people, I'll start with you, Angela.
Yeah, I think this is definitely weighing on the minds of voters, especially those who have decided and have been decided for some time. There are voters among us who have been waiting for Donald Trump to be impeached since the Mueller report. There are those of us who thought that Ukraine should have been beyond the tipping point, and that should have been just another article. But it wasn't. When you consider what he was actually impeached for in the House, Mueller wasn't even present, right? And I think that is a tough reality. The other thing that we have to consider is, and I've raised this a lot, whether or not Democrats waited too late for this, the fact that it is going right into the heart of primary season. How much longer will it take and how will it matter?
Well, that's because the speaker actually did not want to move forward with this. I want to bring you in, Matt, because really, I'm thinking about supporters of Trump. Does this embolden them? What are your thoughts on this and as they're watching this impeachment trial?
Yeah, it seems to me impeachment is working to kind of fire up the base of both parties. I haven't seen any evidence that voters in the middle, that the very small number of truly persuadable undecided voters is moving because of impeachment. And I think since impeachment's likely to resolve itself in the next perhaps few days, if not certainly a couple weeks, we got to remember the election, you know, by the time it comes around, impeachment will be 9 months in the rearview mirror. And so I just have, from the beginning, have not believed impeachment is going to matter that much in the 2020 election. We are facing a consequential decision by the Senate likely on Friday related to witnesses. You know, depending on what time of day, the last couple of days, it's looked like it might go one direction or the other.
Do you want John Bolton to testify? Is that something you want to hear from him?
So the short answer is, look, I think that there can be benefit from him testifying, yes. He obviously is a fact witness. He was in the room for a lot of these things. However, I also think that senators, if a majority of the Senate decides they have enough information to make a decision, then that's fine too, right? I mean, if I were a senator, would I like to hear from Bolton? Sure. I think that witness reciprocity would make sense, whether the Republicans were to call Hunter Biden, Joe Biden, the whistleblower, or someone else. You know, going one for one, I think, is a fair way to approach it.
What do you think about that, Angela, this idea of having Joe Biden testify in exchange for John Bolton? Or what are your thoughts on this?
I think it's ridiculous. I think that when you consider the fact that Hillary Clinton during the 2016 election had to testify on Benghazi, and there's no way that Donald Trump, after being impeached by the House, this is not just impeachment at this point. This is about removal. He will never see a witness stand or witness table in the United States Senate. And I don't think this is about one for one. I think it is about the fact that there has has been a clear cover-up, and this administration doesn't want to be accountable for that. I'm not just using a Democratic talking point. There are facts that have led us to believe that that is, in fact, what has happened. And you can continue to point the finger as a distraction to Joe Biden, or you can really want to get to the heart of what it means to be a patriot in this country, and that means to allow people who were in the room who saw Donald Trump utilize and abuse his power, testify and get to the bottom of this.
Let's talk a little bit about closing arguments and that argument. Trump's attorney, Jay Sekulow, talking about Trump's July 25th phone call during his closing arguments with Ukraine's president, in which they spoke about military aid and investigations.
The president of the United States knew when he was on that call there were a lot of people listening from our side and from their side. So he knew what he was saying. He said it. We released a transcript of it.
Matt, do you feel like this is a defense? I mean, he's admitting to talking about investigations and also holding up military aid.
Well, I mean, again, I think the transcript is pretty clear about what was said and what wasn't said, who brought certain subjects up and who didn't.
By definition is not exactly a transcript, but yes.
Well, no one that I know who's serious has claimed that the transcript does not reflect what was said. Either way, setting that aside, it seems to me that where I think Senate Republicans have come down on is that they don't believe that abuse of power or obstruction of Congress is an impeachable offense in and of itself. And so whether John Bolton testifies or not, doesn't change the question of whether those are truly impeachable offenses or not. I mean, the Democrats have charged lots of things against Donald Trump just over this Ukraine stuff. They've talked about bribery. They've talked about extortion. They've talked about campaign finance violations. That's not what the impeachment articles say. The impeachment articles are these other two things that are not criminal violations, that are not statutory violations. They're sort of in a different category entirely. So that's if the Senate Republicans ultimately determine not to call new witnesses, that I think will be the reason why.
Let's take a bigger picture here. Angela, do you think Democrats could ultimately pay a political price for impeaching and voting to remove the president? Are you at all concerned about that?
I'm not concerned because they did the right thing. Doing the right thing, whether early, on time, or late, is always important. And I just hope that the leadership that has come out of the Democratic Party in the House and the Senate somehow rubs off on what has become the feckless Senate Republican majority. It is time to do the right thing. And it is laughable to say that abuse of power or obstruction of Congress, which is obstruction of justice, are not impeachable offenses. People are charged for those things. Obstruction of justice is a criminal charge, right, in any other sense. And I cannot believe that this is the conversation we're have going into 2020. I cannot imagine what the conversation would be if we were talking about Barack Obama.
I want to talk to you guys about the Iowa caucuses, which are which will be next week. But I want to talk about something else that just happened this week. Were either of you surprised to see the president unveil this Middle East peace plan in the midst of the impeachment trial and really excluding Democrats from today's signing of the USMCA trade deal? Let's hear Trump this morning thanking Senate Republicans.
And maybe I'm being just nice to him because I want their vote. Does that make sense? I don't want to leave anybody out.
Matt, but he did leave someone out. I mean, he left. He couldn't have gotten this deal passed without Democrats.
Well, sure. And it would have been customary in a traditional sense to have both parties there. On the other hand, I mean, Congress is going through impeachment right now. So it is a hyper-partisan time. I can understand why he doesn't want to go above and beyond and socialize with Democrats at the moment. I mean, they don't want to socialize with him. The language the Democrats have used about President Trump over the first 3 years is unlike anything we've ever seen in politics. And so we are at a very low point right now. I do think the president will be acquitted the next few days or few weeks, and hopefully we can move beyond that and talk about infrastructure and prescription drugs and highway funding bill and all kinds of other things that need to get done this year.
Okay, let's talk a bit about the 2020 election with the time I have with you. The Democrats running for president are making their final arguments ahead of the Iowa caucuses on Monday. Former Vice President Joe Biden remains the national front runner, but Bernie Sanders is in second place, and he's gaining ground at this point. Is Iowa Bernie Sanders to lose? Angela, what do you think?
I think if you look at current polling, the answer is yes. I think that the reality of the Democratic Party is that it is super fractured. The big tent is one that has to soon decide if the tent is large enough to encompass all of these varying perspectives on policy issues. And I don't know that that is the case. I think that what you're seeing is that there are some concerns about age. There are some concerns about policy. Mm-hmm. There are some concerns about who can beat Trump versus what I really want. And you're seeing people wrestle with this throughout this election.
Yeah, Matt, I saw that you tweeted a story about how it would be crazy for Sanders to be the Democratic nominee against Trump if that happens. Why do you feel that way?
Yeah, it was from Jonathan Chait, and his basic point is that Sanders is unnecessarily risky, and I think that's probably right. I think if you think about sort of positioning, the question in the general election is going to be who can go after those voters in the middle, who can go after suburban voters that helped build the Democratic majority in 2018, and I think Sanders on the far left of the ideological spectrum makes that easier for Trump. Trump's going to call whoever the Democratic nominee is a socialist, but in Bernie Sanders' case, he won't deny it, I imagine. So I think if he wins Iowa, you're going to see the Democratic Party have a total freak out, and he may then win New Hampshire as well, and he may be very difficult to stop.
A lot to watch for. That's Angela Rye. She is a Democratic strategist, and Matt Makowiak is a Republican strategist. Thank you both for taking the time.
Thanks a lot.
People are bracing for aftershocks today following a 7.7 magnitude earthquake off the coasts of Jamaica, Cuba, and the Cayman Islands yesterday. The shaking could be felt in Florida. Earlier this month, a less powerful quake caused major damage in Puerto Rico, and the island is still experiencing aftershocks. Joining us now is Gavin Hayes. He is a seismologist at the U.S. Geological Survey. Hi, Gavin.
Hi.
And how would you describe what is happening along those faults that run beneath the Caribbean?
So what we're seeing in Puerto Rico and yesterday near the Cayman Islands is an expression of where the North America plate collides with the Caribbean plate. There's a long plate boundary north of Puerto Rico and directly through where yesterday's earthquake occurred. And over time, that plate boundary builds up stresses and we get earthquakes on faults aligned with those plate boundary structures.
So is the earthquake that we saw yesterday related to the one that struck Puerto Rico on January 7th?
They're related in that they're occurring close to the same plate boundary. The Puerto Rico earthquakes were not actually on the plate boundary itself, but were caused by the stresses related to those plate motions. But they are over 800 miles apart, so they are not directly related to one another in that the Puerto Rico earthquakes did not cause the earthquakes yesterday near the Cayman Islands.
Yesterday's earthquake, the magnitude was 7.7, very powerful. Are you surprised that there wasn't major damage or more injuries?
Fortunately, the earthquake started about 100 kilometers offshore of Cuba and Jamaica. And while it did break a fault about maybe 120 miles long towards the Cayman Islands, that fault motion was still offshore. And so the shaking felt on land was less than it would have been had the earthquake been closer to land.
Is that the difference in 2010, for example, when more than 300,000 people in Haiti died from an even less powerful quake?
That's spot on, yeah. The 2010 magnitude 7.1 earthquake in Haiti was right next to Port-au-Prince. And unfortunately, the less than ideal construction in that city caused the massive damage that we saw as a result of that earthquake.
So how does this area of the Earth compare seismically to others? Is it more active than a lot of other places on the globe?
The Caribbean is in general a little less active than other parts. The plates in the Caribbean are coming together at a rate of about 2 centimeters per year. So that's about a half of the rate that your fingernails grow. Compare that to, say, the San Andreas Fault in California that's moving at about the rate that your fingernails grow, or the subduction zone in South America, offshore Chile, where we've seen massive earthquakes in the past, that moves at a rate of about 7 centimeters a year, which is obviously a lot faster than this. So in places like Chile or Japan, you can get large earthquakes more frequently than we see them in the Caribbean.
There was a tsunami warning after yesterday's quake. It was later withdrawn, but generally speaking, how big is the tsunami risk in that area?
In this part of the Caribbean, specifically to the south of Cuba, the plate boundary results in horizontal motion. When we have horizontal motions, that generally doesn't cause the seafloor uplift that is required to generate a tsunami. Further to the east, near Puerto Rico and the Lesser Antilles, you do get the North America plate sinking beneath the Caribbean. So when you have large earthquakes in that part of the world, you can get the vertical motion of the seafloor that you need to generate a tsunami if the earthquake is big enough.
That's Gavin Hayes, a seismologist at the United States Geological Survey based in Colorado. Gavin, thanks for speaking with us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you, Peter.
There are now 5 days until the first votes are cast in the presidential election. The Iowa caucuses are on Monday, and it's anybody's guess what will happen. Polls show five candidates in double digits: Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, and Amy Klobuchar. Here and Now's Jeremy Hobson is in Iowa, where he will be hosting the show tomorrow and Friday from Cedar Falls. He spoke earlier today with Amy Klobuchar, who is in Washington for the Senate impeachment trial.
Well, Senator, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, sure. It's great to be on.
Well, and you flew into Iowa last night. It sounds like we missed you just barely, but you're now back in Washington for the impeachment trial. How difficult has it been for your campaign to have to spend time in Washington in this impeachment trial in the Senate?
You know, I have a constitutional duty to be part of this trial, and I can't think of anything more important to be doing right now. You know, I'm a competitive person. Do I wish I was back going to every town hall meeting I could? Sure, I have those moments. But the fact that we were able to take that one break when we got out a little early, get back, I told everyone I would turn into a pumpkin by midnight, and I got back to the trial. And that's what I'm going to have to do. We've done three teletown halls. I have the most endorsements of legislators and former legislators in the state of Iowa than anyone else in the race. And so I have surrogates out there all the time, including my own daughter and husband. And we're pretty excited about the momentum we're seeing. We just got a poll, Emerson poll this week, that showed we were in third place. So I'm surging at this moment, and I just have to hope that this grassroots process is going to work and that people understand that because of my constitutional duty to be at this impeachment hearing, I am not going to be able to be there every moment of the day. And I think people out there, Americans, get that.
The New York Times reported this week that the Biden campaign has proposed a caucus alliance with your campaign, meaning that if one of you is not viable, that you would urge your supporters to go with the other one. Is that true?
I have had nothing to do with that. I learned last night that they approached someone who is not even on our staff about it. And I am surging right now. I have no intention of making deals with other campaigns. And it's always nice when people ask, but I am not going to be part of that.
Let me ask you, you say you're surging, but in a recent poll, you, like Pete Buttigieg, are struggling very much with African-American voters in national polls, down around 1%. How can you be the nominee of the Democratic Party without enthusiastic support from Black voters?
And I've always had that enthusiastic support in my own state. And it's on me to get people to get to know me better. My name idea is significantly different than someone like Vice President Biden or Bernie Sanders, who's run for president before. And I know that. So it's on me to have people get to know me. I'd start in Iowa, where they have gotten to know me. And two of four of the African-American legislators have endorsed me. Ruth Ann Gaines, and then just last week, Ross Wilburn, who had previously been with my friend Kamala Harris. So I've built support with that community, and they have supported me. Why? Because they know I have a strong plan on economic opportunity, that they know that I've been a leader, the leader on voting rights in the U.S. Senate, including my plans to register every kid when they turn 18 automatically to vote and have gerrymandering stop that with independent commission in every state and stop these voting purges. A bill I lead with Sherrod Brown that would get at the problem that Stacey Abrams has been talking about for the entire year. Well, without it, she might have been governor of Georgia right now. They also know that I have been a leader from the beginning on sentencing reform, on things like the First Step Act. And so it's on me to have people get to know me better, and that is my plan as I go state by state. I don't have the money of some of my opponents to run a ad during the Super Bowl and those kinds of things, so I'm just going to have to do it the old-fashioned way, state by state.
But you think name ID is the biggest problem that you're having with black voters after all these months of campaigning?
Yeah, because I haven't been able to advertise in those states because I have to be smart about my advertising budget. And then as we go through a primary, as has been happened before, the voters in each state will get to know me. That's the only way I can do it. Like I said, I don't have the money of Michael Bloomberg or some of these other people.
As you've said, you say you're surging. Bernie Sanders would also say that he is surging right now. Do you think that he could beat President Trump in a general election, or do you think that he could win the state of Minnesota, which you have, in a general election?
Well, first of all, in Minnesota, when you look at the numbers, there was a poll about a month or so ago that showed I beat Donald Trump by 17%. I beat him with men. I beat him in bigger numbers than Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden. That's a state that knows me best. And it just shows what I can bring in when people get to know me in terms of a fired up Democratic base, as well as independents and moderate Republicans. That's why I think I would be the better candidate to lead this ticket than my friend Senator Sanders. It's simply, you do the math. You look at what I've been able to do. Win in the reddest of red districts and still keeping a fired up urban Democratic base. I do that by being straight with people, by being the one on that debate stage that's passed over 100 bills as the lead Democrat, and the one that showed that I'm able to unify our party and our country.
So do you think that he would be able to beat President Trump in a general?
I would hope so, but my argument is a little different. My argument is that I would not just win, but I would win big. I would be able to bring with me, this is why I have the endorsement of all those legislators. I have the track record of winning and taking over and switching House seats. I literally have won back the Minnesota House every single time that I have led the ticket. And so when you look at the landscape nationally, we have to win in these Senate races in states like Colorado and states like Arizona. And when you look at who won in governor's races, they were people more like me. Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan, Laura Kelly in Kansas. They won in states that not everyone thought we could win. It's not always being a celebrity. It's whether or not you're going to be able to bring people with you. We want to win back the Senate. We want to send Mitch McConnell packing. And eking by a victory at 4 a.m. isn't going to do that for us. We have to win big with that kind of coalition, which is exactly what was pointed out when the New York Times endorsed me, when the Manchester Union leader endorsed me in New Hampshire, the Keene newspaper, Quad City Times. So I'm not just like making it up. I actually have the proof points here.
Let me finally just ask you, as you head back into the impeachment trial today, do you think that there will be witnesses, which I guess would also mean, do you think you're going to be able to, after Iowa, head to New Hampshire next week, or will you be stuck in Washington for the trial then too?
I'm going to be doing whatever I have to do, and I sure hope there'll be witnesses. There are signs of some cracks on the other side. Senator Romney has long said he wanted to see witnesses, and a number of the other senators seem interested. And I just keep looking over at them. My desk is right in the middle of the floor with Sherrod Brown and Bob Casey and Chris Coons, and I keep looking over at my colleagues and thinking, why did you run for this office? You know, was it just to buy your chair at the end of your term, which they let you do, and have it in your office at home? Was it to have a trophy on the wall or a title for life? No, you came here to Washington to represent the people of this country and to follow the Constitution. And no matter how you vote on impeachment, at least you have to get to the truth. And I think the stunning revelations about John Bolton's book show what I have been saying all along. I literally have been saying, not knowing the title of his book, that we need to hear from the men that were in the room where it happened. That is becoming very stark, because as I listen to the president's lawyers sit there and nitpick about this email and this fact, I'm thinking, what are you doing? We have the person that can answer the questions of what actually happened. That appears to be completely verifying what these career military and career diplomats like Marie Yovanovitch have testified to under oath. So let's just bring them in, ask the questions. And, you know, one of my favorite suggestions, we said, well, why don't we just let John Roberts, the conservative justice, decide what's relevant? We know John Bolton's testimony is relevant, and we have to hear from him. So that is my hope, that after we're done with these 2 days of questions today and tomorrow, where we submit written questions, that the next day they will agree to have witnesses, and who knows how long it will take, but I will be here as long as it takes.
That is Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat running for president. Senator, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. It was great to be on.
With more than 6,000 confirmed cases of the coronavirus in mainland China, the Trump administration is warning airlines this week that it might ban all U.S. flights to and from China if the risk to public health increases. So far, the State Department is telling Americans not to travel to Hubei, the province at the epicenter of the outbreak. It's also advising people to reconsider trips to any part of the country. Let's bring in Seth Kaplan. He's Here and Now transportation analyst. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Peter.
So you're an airline guy. Let's start with the airline news that British Airways is now the first airline to cancel all of its flights to and from China this week. There are other carriers like Lion Air of Indonesia and Seoul Air in South Korea. They're doing the same. Some U.S. carriers have decided to cut back a little bit. But that's a big decision. What goes into something like that?
Well, it's a commercial decision, but also, of course, a safety decision. Commercially, the reality is that demand for travel to and from China has dropped. So just like when demand to anywhere drops, you're just not going to need as many flights. Airlines, of course, also have to look at the safety of their own personnel. In terms of the White House, they, of course, need to look just at safety. And it's tricky because banning flights between the U.S. and China isn't the same as banning travel between the U.S. and China. Hmm. You know, people connect between China and the U.S. in places like South Korea, places like Canada. So, you know, in some ways it makes it trickier. I mean, the good thing about a flight coming in from China is at least you know where everybody came from. Trickier almost to screen everybody coming off a flight from Toronto, right?
So, yes, safety is a question, but that's a lot of lost revenue. How much could the airlines be hurt ultimately by this outbreak, especially if the Trump administration does go ahead and eventually ban all flights?
Well, I think the importance of banning flights by the administration actually kind of drops each day as airlines do more of this on their own. What also helps them from a financial standpoint, again, not to minimize the tragedy here, is just the fact that China has been a difficult market financially for them anyway for the past year or so. American mm-hmm. Airlines got rid of some of its flights from Chicago to China for commercial reasons last year, and they've since said that that has actually helped their profits. So you sort of have a forced capacity reduction in a market that's been difficult anyway. Now you have all those big expensive airplanes that then you have to decide what else to do with. So this is by no means the way airlines would hope to reduce capacity in a problematic market, but it is, from a financial standpoint at least, not a market where they've been doing all that well recently.
We've been watching the U.S. government's effort to evacuate Americans from Wuhan. What can you tell us about that? How's it going?
Yeah, reports of a giant 747 is one example that was chartered, came in and arrived to cheers from people there, stopped in Alaska on the way back first, where people were screened, and then finally at an Air Reserve base in Southern California, where they also will continue to be screened under somewhat of a quarantine situation, but obviously far more comfortably than what they faced back in China.
Right. Seth, another airline story that we often talk to you about is Boeing and its struggle to get the 737 MAX back into operation. I'm sure you saw this news that Boeing posted its first annual loss today since 1997. It lost $636 million last year. Compare that to 2018. It made $10 billion in profit. Here's Boeing's new CEO, David Calhoun, on CNBC this morning saying that despite all this, he's still confident in the 737 MAX.
We do need confidence as we launch this airplane, but the underlying engineering of the airplane, the demonstrated performance outside that one moment where boundary conditions were not provided for, I believe in this airplane.
Calhoun's got to believe in this airplane because it's so important to Boeing, but does everybody else?
Well, Boeing shares rose today on the earnings release anyway. Of course, the losses. That's not investors expressing confidence that they're or being thrilled with the results. That's more people just kind of exhaling, being relieved that the news wasn't worse.
Could have been worse,
Yeah, that there wasn't more bad news today because there's already so much bad news baked in to that share price, which of course is much lower than where it stood a year ago.
Boeing, speaking of bad news, expects the MAX-related losses to exceed $18 billion. CNBC reported this week that the company just secured a $12 billion loan from various banks. The company needs cash. It's probably not used to being in that situation. How existential of a crisis is this for the future of Boeing?
Well, I'm sure some of why it's raising cash is just that we are in a fairly low interest rate environment, and that's just sort of Boeing managing its balance sheet. This is a company that's still worth $180 billion or so, still ranked among the 50 or so most valuable companies in the world. Now, yeah, that's down $70 billion or so from where it was less than a year ago, so it's been pounded. But that's not the kind of valuation that a company has when investors are concerned about its viability as a company, even though, a company that's clearly lost a lot of its luster.
And just quickly, Seth, how close are we to getting these planes back in the air?
Boeing has said mid-year. They haven't kind of been any more specific about that for recertification, but it looks like definitely well into the second half of this year before you see commercial flights, before you see passengers back on board, those that are willing to get onto these
planes. Yeah. Seth Kaplan, Here and Now's transportation analyst. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Peter.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. We'll broadcast from Iowa, where the caucuses are just days away. We'll hear from voters, experts, and also from former candidate and DNC chair Howard Dean. He made all the headlines on the night of the Democratic caucuses in 2004.
The most headlines of anybody that ever came in third.
Right. We'll broadcast from Iowa next time on Here and Now.